Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the June 9th joint presentation by the Santa Clarita Valley Chapter and the South Bay Chapter of the Aerospace and Defense Forum. This morning's topic is M&A trends in the aerospace industry and guidance for small to medium-sized companies on how to be prepared. I'm George Ewell, the chairman of the Aerospace and Defense Forum South Bay Chapter, and Senior Relationship Manager and Aerospace Industry Specialist at Citizens Business Bank. Now, for those of you who may not know what the mission of the Aerospace and Defense Forum is, the purpose of the forum is to provide a way for those in and supporting of the aerospace industry and to communicate information and ideas to each other and to collaborate on projects and develop business with each other. The Aerospace and Defense Forum is 11 years old, and in absence of the global pandemic, we normally have 9 chapters now who meet monthly in person. The most recent chapter to be part of the A&D Forum is the Ventura chapter. Now, in addition to the monthly newsletter that gets emailed out to everybody who has signed up. On the website, there's over 230 recordings of past A&D Forum presentations and tours of A&D sites. Now, to continue fulfilling the purpose of the A&D Forum, we plan to have at least 3 webinars a month until in-person meetings can be resumed. More information may be found on the website of aerospacedefenseforum.org. Now, I'd like to get into a little bit of logistics now for everybody. You should be on mute upon entering the webinar. There is a mic icon that you should be able to see that should be crossed out. And if not, please click on it to mute. And likewise, the video camera should be crossed. Okay, so please click on the video camera to turn your video off. Now, we want to have some engagement and participation here, so all questions will be handled through the chat function at the end of the presentation. So to ask a question, locate the chat icon and click on the center of that, and the chat window will appear where you can ask your question. And we'll go over those questions at the end of the presentation. A recording of this webinar will be posted on the A&D Forum website for download by A&D Forum members. I want to make sure you know that all attendees will also receive an email when this recording is available. And then likewise, all attendees will receive the contact information for everyone signed up and granted permission. Okay. All right. So, and one of the things we want to recognize here is the our sponsors of the A&D Forum for each chapter. And I'd like to recognize our respective chapter sponsors. For the Santa Clarita Valley chapter, it's sponsored by the Santa Clarita Economic Development Corporation. And the South Bay chapter is currently has the sponsors of Moss Adams CPA Firm, Bolton & Company Insurance, and Chubb Insurance. So at this time, I'm going to turn the program over to Eric Jensen, the chapter chairman for the Santa Clarita Valley chapter. Eric is also president for Jensen Leadership Management Consulting and was instrumental in putting this morning's presentation together. So Eric, if you could please introduce and give some background on our presenters, we all would appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, George. Good morning, everybody. And thank you, Paul and Scott, for participating in this, and Marlon for setting it up. Some background on our presenters. Paul Croce, he's the head of Aerospace and Defense Investment Banking at Wells Fargo Securities in New York. He joined the firm in 2019. He's been an investment banker for over 15 years, advising companies in the aerospace and defense industry, primarily at Citigroup and Barclays Capital. He led corporate development and served on the leadership team for the aerospace division of Honeywell, $12 billion in revenue. And I think we all recognize Honeywell. His deep experience and expertise, strategic advisory experience in business jet, space, defense, aerospace, and government service markets, including transactions led to EDO and its sale to ITT. Paul is a graduate of the United States Naval Academy, where he earned a BS in mechanical engineering. He's also a distinguished graduate from the University of Michigan Ross School of Business, where he earned his MBA. And he served as a nuclear submarine officer. Thank you, Paul, for joining us. And now I want to introduce Scott Trigizevich. Scott is director in the Regional Investment Banking Group at Wells Fargo Security in Southern California, the Los Angeles area. He joined the firm in 2011 with the Transportation and Logistics Group in New York City. 2014, he relocated to Los Angeles, and he is originally from the Los Angeles area, and he leads the coverage for Southern California. He has a geographic focus. He's worked on key deals across several sectors and products, including sell-side advisor to J.T. Posey Company on its sale to TD Products, Roundtail Healthcare Partners, and sell-side advisor to Haddon House Food Products on its sale to United Natural Foods, and lead arranger on the financing for RBC Bearings acquisition of Sargent Aerospace and Defense. Prior to joining Wells Fargo, Scott played 6 seasons of professional baseball in the Toronto Blue Jays organization. Scott received his BA in economics from Stanford University and an MBA from the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. And Paul and Scott partner together often to work programs and projects and deals. So thank you, gentlemen. And I will turn it over to both of you. If we can go to the next slide, please, Ivan.
Eric, thank you so much for that great background. This is Scott. We look forward to a great discussion this morning. And Paul, I think maybe you'll kick us off with some of the slides, and then we'll definitely leave some time at the end for some Q&A.
Thank you, Eric, George, and Scott. It's good to see everyone. Thank you for the time today. We look forward to an interactive discussion. We've prepared a few slides that everyone can see. And we'll sequence it by first chatting through a little bit of what we're seeing in the commercial aerospace industry, then a bit on what we're seeing in the defense industry, and then maybe wrap it all together with some thoughts around the environment for selling companies, given what we discuss in regard to the specific end markets. So first of all, with commercial aerospace, next slide, please. Trading multiples. So companies that are existing public companies, their valuations, where they've traded, and we've taken a 15-year look back at where multiples for companies, that's EBITDA multiples for public companies, have been over the last, call it 15-year period. And the big picture, so to speak, is that both the large cap OEMs is the way to think about them, and then the supply chain, which largely involves mid cap and smaller companies, they've generally traded up over the sweep of history, going back to 2008, coming out of the financial recession, to where we ended up in late 2020 with the COVID discontinuity. It caused a lot of displacement across the industry, also dovetailed with the Boeing difficulties around the MAX and some of their other platforms. The broad sweep of history is that multiples, trading valuations, if you will, have trended upward over that time span. And why is that? One, there's been a lot of optimism in the industry. Backlogs have grown and remained robust. A lot of investors believe that the aerospace industry had become almost immune to cycles. You know, that of course has been disrupted by both the MAX issue and COVID. But as you can see, the most recent multiples have rebounded quite sharply. And that's largely on the back of the fundamental fact that the world is globally interconnected and irrevocably so, regardless of how long we continue to have the challenges associated with COVID. Inevitably, we're all going to get back on airplanes, airlines are going to buy more aircraft, and there's just going to be substantial recovery. Over a much longer sweep of history, call it 50 years, aerospace, travel, and demand from both individuals and businesses for travel is a almost uninterrupted upward sloping graph. And I see no reason for that to somehow change. And that's reflected in the valuations. Maybe just a comment on the 18 times and the 13 times. Those are certainly elevated because they're forward multiples. And, you know, last year's earnings were severely impacted by COVID, and folks are looking forward to 22 and 23 and even 24 for a sense of what is a more realistic assessment of the run rate levels of profitability of companies. Long-winded way of saying that current valuation multiples of current or even one-year forward earnings are at historically elevated levels. So next slide, please. In terms of transactions, it's been relatively light. There just hasn't been a lot in the COVID era. And that's mainly because of what I just mentioned. There's a pretty significant disconnect between the levels of profitability, EBITDA generation for businesses over the last year and kind of what they're running at now versus their ultimate potential. And so buyers and sellers are, at a bit of a disagreement or it's very difficult to agree on exactly what the slope of the recovery might look like, when it's going to begin. But I think those clouds are beginning to lift as we're seeing, you know, strong return of individuals to travel. Both business jet is effectively recovered up back to levels pre-pandemic, certainly in the States. Commercial aviation is, you know, ballpark 75% recovered on a domestic basis. So as those passengers return, revenue will begin to flow back through to individual players. And once we get a quarter or two of solid improvement quarter over quarter, I think the slope of the recovery will be much more clearly defined, and buyers and sellers will be able to agree on valuation levels. Again, the big point is there just haven't been a lot of aerospace transactions kind of in the COVID era to point to. I have every expectation that once they do return, they're going to be at or above the multiples that we have sort of shown on this page. Next slide, please. Just a little bit on the history and production levels. A couple of the takeaways that I would point to here. In 2018, the aerospace industry produced approximately 1,800 aircraft, and that production was cut effectively in half, partly due to the grounding of the MAX, which I'm sure everyone is very well aware of. That grounding has been lifted, although importantly, I would note it has not been lifted in China. Approximately a third of Boeing's backlog orders are for orders into China. So it's an important remaining task for recertifying the MAX and getting it fully on the road to recovery. But between the MAX grounding and then, of course, COVID, which you know, grounded, and at times had the commercial aviation industry down 70 to 80%, really put a double barrel hit, into the supply chain. We're beginning to see, a pretty rapid snapback. I'd say there's a lot of debate over how quickly the supply chain can re-ramp, production. What is shown on this page as far as 21, 22, and 23 production, I'd say is a relatively conservative estimate of what that ramp might look like. And based on the activity over Memorial Day weekend, what I'm hearing from many of my clients, both in the airline industry and throughout the aerospace supply chain, I think this is a pretty conservative view of how long it's going to take for production to re-ramp. One of the important things to note is that there does seem to still be a bit of a lag for the large cabin aircraft. large cabin aircraft, which are used on international travel, as the COVID restrictions for international travel remain quite firmly in place. And the demand for airframes like the 787, the A350, other wide-body platforms remains significantly subdued. So that slower wide-body recovery is what probably holds or tamps down the 2022 and 23 production levels below the former 1800 that was achieved in 2018. So we are on the road to recovery. We will ramp back up close to those 2018 levels over the next couple of years, but maybe a little bit dampened just due to the lag for the wide bodies. Next slide. I've already touched on some of these points, which is passenger traffic. The chart in the upper right-hand corner discusses TSA domestic screenings. So again, this largely excludes international travel, but you can see that in broad terms, domestic TSA screenings are at about approximately 75% of where they were in the pre-pandemic timeframe, which is pretty good. If you go back just a couple, it's a relatively new development. Just a couple of months ago, through the bulk of last year, the industry was hovering at 40 to 50%. And really with the spring travel season, spring break, and the vaccine is the real driver here, folks are increasingly comfortable. And the industry has snapped back to something on the order of 75% of where it formerly was. Next slide. This slide has a lot of information on it, going platform by platform, addressing production rates for both Boeing and Airbus, and makes some of the points that I'd already touched on. You can sort of see in the upper right-hand corner with the 787 and the 777 that production rates for those airframes have come down quite dramatically. The 787 from 11 down to approximately 5. The 777, perhaps two a month. Interestingly, though, the MAX is marching up quite smartly, and Boeing has made some recent announcements about their desire to restart and restore production quite rapidly to try to get back to, mid-40s production levels in the next 24 months. Whether or not the supply chain is going to be in a position to deliver those levels and parts remains to be seen, but it is a positive sign for the extended supply chain that Boeing seems confident that they're going to get back to a production level roughly, in the same zip code as what they had been pre-pandemic and pre the MAX grounding. Airbus, on the other hand, very interestingly, has been quite aggressive in talking. They maintained production. Obviously, they didn't have the issue with their A320 that Boeing had with the MAX. They did maintain production at a reasonably high level through the pandemic, producing, some even white tails. And based on their backlog, they're testing the supply chain to take rates up well into the 70s per month. I think there's some skepticism in the industry that is the right move, but it is interesting. They've noted and made some public statements that they are testing the supply chain to ramp up into the 70s, which suggests between the moves for Boeing and MAX, that Boeing and Airbus over the next 24 months, all industry participants will be able to validate forecasts for pretty sharply upward sloping growth trajectories. Why do I mention all that? From an M&A perspective, being able to point to the production skylines for Boeing and Airbus, the robust recovery in aircraft travel means that forecasts will have very solid double-digit growth rates and improving profitability, which is a wonderful backdrop to sell a business. Next slide, please. A little bit on the in-service fleet and aircraft retirement levels. Depending on what your business focus is in the industry, there's a very vibrant used serviceable material industry out there that competes in some ways with OEM manufactured parts. The key input for that used serviceable material is obviously retiring aircraft and the availability of those airframes. Many forecast that there would be a wave of retirements and a wave of used serviceable material being made available. There were some retirements, but very interestingly, the 2021 retirements are likely going to come in below what it has been, or at or slightly below what it's been in recent years. There wasn't a massive wave of retirements. It will grow in the coming years, but largely no monumental flooding, if you will, of used serviceable material. Next slide. The MRO industry, the chart on the bottom just gives a snapshot of some of the revenue that was, lost or missed due to the fact that so many aircraft were parked. We do stay in touch with a number of the heavier maintenance players. And certainly, a lot of lines were shuttered and work deferred. Aircraft were flown to optimize available green time. But even so, the hit to the MRO segment has been, fairly significant. Also on the lower right, we break down between the twin aisle and the narrow bodies. Even though there are significantly more narrow bodies out there, the wallet and the profitability of the wide bodies is material. So to the extent that the wide body recovery is delayed or lagged relative to narrow bodies, that is going to continue to be a significant drag on a full and true true recovery. The indications I'm getting from many of my clients are, though, that because so much green time was burned off and maintenance actions deferred, that the MRO industry should recover in lockstep, if not slightly ahead of the OEM market. Next slide, please. Again, just a quick snapshot of some of the players and the extent to which they saw their aftermarket activities curtailed during the recession, during the 2020 COVID crisis. No surprise that many of the OEMs, whether it's engine or airframe OEMs, were among the most highly impacted. Whereas players that are further in the supply chain and the components were able to manage their pricing and have somewhat slightly less of a revenue hit because they're able to adjust pricing and continue to perform. I would say that as we come out of the crisis and OEM production ramps back up, we'll see the inverse of this, right? Those that were down the most will probably snap back, the largest and the fastest. So the OEMs likely will see a very nice recovery coming out. Next slide. All right. So with that, we'll pivot to the defense industry a little bit. Next slide, please. Here, a very different picture. The defense industry has maintained a relatively stable trajectory through the COVID crisis and even before. Completely different set of drivers. Valuation multiples, although they have exhibited the same upward trajectory since the 2008 recession. We can have a separate discussion about why have multiples trended upward almost across all industries. It has a lot to do with pervasively low and going lower interest rates. A lot has been made of even negative interest rates throughout the European Union and other large markets around the world. The U.S. has been affected by those same trends. Those low interest rates mean that financing rates are low, improves the willingness and desire of people to put money to work in equity capital markets. And as such, you have relatively high trading multiples. Next slide, please. Defense deal activity has remained robust through the COVID period. Many buyers were quite thankful that they have defense assets. As you all probably know, many businesses have a leg, one foot in both the aerospace commercial arena and the defense markets. There are some nice overlaps and synergies. One of the important benefits of staying in both markets is that they tend to be not correlated. And the folks that had both aerospace and defense exposures, especially through COVID, were incredibly grateful, thankful, and it frankly highlighted the value of having a defense or government service related type exposure. And so many buyers were on the hunt and remained on the hunt through the COVID crisis. to identify and further make acquisitions in the space. And so multiples for actual transactions have remained quite robust. I would say that in the current environment, there is a increasing eye toward fiscal concerns and constraints that might ultimately prove out to put some downward pressure on the defense budget and in turn impact the prospects for defense businesses. So that is definitely a trend that I'm noting amongst many of my clients beginning to think about, you know, what does the 2022, 2023, 2024 budgets by the Biden administration look like as deficits go higher. Next slide, please. Here's a snapshot of a defense budget. I'm sure many of you are very familiar with these trends and slides. You know, the historical facts around, you know, what drove the budgets higher and then sequestration through the sort of 2010 to 14 timeframe. A new administration the kind of, you know, Trump administration took budgets slightly higher over the last few years. The good news is the outlook remains relatively flattish over the next few years. There's been relatively little talk of any sort of a peace dividend or you know, wild swing in defense spending. There's certainly moves to reorient certain elements of the strategy. Some questions being asked around whether or not the three-legged nuclear triad is still relevant and the way to modernize you know, significant parts of the defense longstanding infrastructure. Certainly more of a focus on China, certainly more of a focus on space are some of the bigger themes that we're keeping very close track of in defense circles. But in general, you know, I think there's broad bipartisan consensus that there isn't a reason or a threat environment that allows, you know, significant reductions in defense spending. Next slide. One thing to keep an eye on, though, is the broader fiscal picture. I don't know how many of you spend a great deal of time focusing on what's going on with the federal budget picture. And this chart tries to take a wider swath of history going back to in some of the charts back to World War II days. And, you know, one of the things that's particularly interesting is that our debt to GDP ratio as a nation has gone over 100%. So that means we have more debt than the country generates in annual gross domestic product. Does it matter? Interest rates have continued to go lower and stay low. But if those interest rates move up even marginally, the impact to the annual budget becomes quite significant, right? The interest on, you know, $20+ trillion of federal debt, you know, 1% move in the interest the government has to pay on that debt significantly eats into the ability to fund other programs in a given year. And so, you know, the bottom chart illustrates the extent of the deficit, which is the amount of money that we spend in excess of tax revenue. And you can see a pretty noticeable spike due to the very substantial COVID relief that was passed. How long and how much more spending is baked in excess of the deficit. There are various proposals to, you know, both increase taxes and or curtail spending to try to, you know, bring things more in line. The one observation I would make out of all this is that, you know, given this information, I think most pundits would agree it is difficult to see a world in which taxes through a broad swath of categories stay at their current levels, that there will have to be some combination of spending reductions and tax increases to begin to bring spending and tax revenues more in line. Next slide, please. This category chart just gives a little bit of a sense of the different categories of spending, you know, generally remaining largely unchanged. But, you know, I would point that aircraft systems, you know, given that we're an aerospace and defense forum, that aircraft systems, space systems, the actual hardware procurement plans remain largely intact and reasonably well funded. Next slide. So, you know, broadly speaking, the aerospace industry is in a broad recovery with a great and bright outlook. The defense industry remains pretty stable, steady as it goes. And so maybe with that, I'll turn things over to Scott to comment a bit on, you know, sort of some of the things that you might consider if you're thinking about exiting in the near future. Scott?
Great. Thanks, Paul. And Eric, we can jump to the next slide. What we tried to lay out on this slide was really some of our thoughts on preparing for a sale. Paul touched on a lot of the themes we're seeing across the industry. You know, hitting a high level, valuations clearly are high. One of the key elements he touched on was the view of growth and profitability and how that may impact an ability to transact. And so what we thought we'd have a couple minute discussion on is just if that is a path of interest for you, what are some of the steps that you can take now as you prepare for the future? And I would say that Paul and my view on this is it's better to be prepared, best to be prepared. So whether you are considering an opportunity to sell, maybe this is helpful if you're looking at opportunities to make an acquisition. These steps also help you have a sense for what the other side is doing. So starting from the top, I think the first one is objectives. And this one sounds pretty obvious, but it might be the most important one on the page, which is really understanding what your objectives are from a management perspective, from an ownership perspective, from a succession planning perspective. What are you looking for now and in the future? And what does the business look like in 2, 3, 5 years down the road? Dovetailing on that, what are the options? What options are available? We list a couple here, right? So one is sell the business. We call this straight sale. Two is IPO. So for the public, for the private companies in the audience, as you guys continue to gain scale, thinking through the pros and cons of having a public entity. Private placement means accepting capital from either debt or equity holders in a private context. And the last one, which we'll spend a minute on in a slide or two, is SPAC activity, which I'm sure everyone on the phone has seen some headlines recently about the SPAC activity. We'll touch on that in a minute. Developing a 5-year growth plan, Paul touched on this early. He explained why the valuation levels seem to be trending up and why snapshot in time were kind of at all-time highs, both in the aerospace side and the defense side, close to all-time highs. And a lot of it has to do with the expectation for growth and then the profitability that flows from that. And so really clearly understanding your 5-year growth plan is something that we highly recommend. Does it have to be 5 years? That's a long time away, and I'm sure everyone can understand the complexity of really imagining where you're going to be in 5 years. Our view is that investors in the market today really do kind of look at that 5-year window. It doesn't have to be perfect, but the directional guidance on how the business might grow gives investors a really clear view of where the business is going. Resolving any lingering tax, ownership, and accounting issues, that's something about just kind of cleaning up the books and making sure the management team and processes are in place. Generally, in a process, we advise business owners to think about 2 to 3 years of financial audits. Depends on the growth of the business. For the higher growing businesses, you're going to have less of a timeline of performance. For the longer term businesses, looking further into the past from an audit perspective, we think best positions you to present yourself well to the market. Second to last one here is talking about your team. So agreements for your key team members, senior staff that can help with executing a transaction, whether that's finance, legal, accounting. That's something that is great to get ahead of as opposed to making adjustments while in place. And then the last piece, we wouldn't be investment bankers if we didn't suggest retaining investment bankers. But I do think the key piece here is there are advisors both on the legal side and on the finance side that can help through the process. And getting your company in a position to succeed and then having great advisors by your side going through a process is something that we think is key to efficient execution. Next slide, please. So we thought we'd take a shot at, and Paul really hit on some of these themes, but what does the market look like today and what does it look like in the future? So you see the two columns here. One is the current environment. The second is the outlook. And from a financing perspective, Paul touched on this. part of the reason we believe that the M&A activity is as robust as it is today is because of the financing environment, and we expect that financing environment to persist. So what does that mean? We talk a little bit about the potential of the Fed raising rates, which certainly could happen, but from a historical perspective, the cost of debt is kind of at an all-time low level. On the equity side, the equity markets the public equity markets are very liquid. We're seeing a lot of activity. And on the private equity side, we're seeing the amount of private equity in the system, dry powder, as we call it, is as high as we've ever seen. And so we think there's a lot of capital looking for deployment. So today versus the future, that appears to be good going forward. Tax considerations is a big one. This, if I was to, rank the level of conversations we're having across industry here in Southern California right now, tax is kind of at the top of the list. As many of you are following, I'm sure the Biden administration has proposed several meaningful tax changes. One of the ones that's most closely followed on our side from an M&A perspective is the capital gains rate. And so the current proposal suggests that the capital gains rate will increase. The levels, depending on how you want to measure with state implications, is around 25% today. And the proposal is to take it north of 40%. And so as you think about that as a selling business owner, has a meaningful impact on your strategy. Interestingly, most recently, the administration has suggested that capital gains change is retroactive to April of 2021. So we are seeing a lot of activity of business owners preparing for sale today to get ahead of that tax change. Depending on what Congress ultimately concludes, it may be a moot point if it's retroactive. Our view is we've got a ways to go in figuring this tax discussion out. And so it will continue to kind of twist and turn in the coming quarters, but something we're clearly following. And as you can see on the page here, we kind of mark that as a yellow light as there's some uncertainty about what happens from the tax perspective. Paul spent a ton of time on the industry outlook, so I'll go quickly on aerospace and defense, the next two ones. I think that the theme that Paul hit on was there seems to be a lot of growth on the aerospace side. There's expectations of growth and profitability. On the defense side, defense held in pretty well. So we have a yellow dot here, but in general, Paul hit on a lot of the key themes in the positive outlook. The next two are what buyers are thinking about. So we bucket the first one into strategic. So that's businesses that have an operating business, either competitors or businesses that are adjacent to you in the supply chain. And then the second one is financial sponsors. That is what we call, private equity. So investors that have capital, but maybe not the operational expertise. And you can see a lot of green dots here, meaning that we think the appetite, both on the strategic side and the sponsor side, is robust today and will remain so. And then the final one is SPAC, which we're going to go to next, which I'll explain. I'm sure some have a basic understanding, but I'll start from the foundational level here to kind of walk through the SPAC activity and how it's driving the market. There is some uncertainty of the SPAC market, which we'll talk about on the next slide. So, Eric, if you can flip forward one, we'll go to the next slide. Okay, so a couple minutes on SPAC, and then we're going to be close to the end, and we'll open up for some questions. So a SPAC is an acronym for Special Purpose Acquisition Companies, you see at the top. And in short, what a SPAC is it's a group of investors who pool their money with the intention of making an acquisition. So I think if there's kind of three steps in a simplified view, there's three steps to a SPAC. Step number one is a group of investors pooling their capital and going public. They run an IPO with a group of individuals with some expertise and some ideas. And what they have is cash. They have cash available to go make an acquisition. That's the IPO step, step one. Step two then is going in and looking for targets that they can buy with this cash that they've developed. As a part of this second step, they will go to what we call PIPE investors, private investors in public equity. They'll go to other investors to kind of validate the acquisition target that they've identified and really validate the strategic rationale and also the valuation. So step two is kind of evaluating opportunities, finding a target. And then step three is what we call de-SPAC, which is when the pool of capital, the public entity merges with the target and combines. So on the back end of it, you have a publicly traded company with operations, and the IPO is really a reverse merger. That private company, previously private company, dumps out as a public entity with stock, with public investors, and operating in the public sphere. So why the activity? Why the bump in activity in the SPAC community? And there's a couple reasons why. One is, we talked about the availability of private equity capital. There's a lot of private equity looking for deployment. And this has provided a way really for that private equity capital to be deployed. I think the second main reason is there's been some kind of accounting complexity that makes a SPAC transition more common now than it has in the past. And it really has to do around with that pipe step. SPACs have been around for a long time. The pipe portion of the transaction, which was step two, as I described it, really has become into prevalence more recently. And what it allows, without going into too much complexity on the transaction, it allows some validation of the idea, some validation of the combination and the strategic rationale from sophisticated investors. And it's really fueled the activity. Now, I will say the reason why we put the yellow dot on the previous page was because there is currently the SEC and the government are looking at kind of the accounting treatment, some of the structuring considerations of the pipe process, and it's added a little uncertainty to the equation, and so we've seen the SPAC activity kind of fall dramatically in the near term. Our expectation is there will be some normalization and we'll see some SPAC activity moving forward, potentially not as robust as it was 6 to 12 months ago. So the pros and cons of the SPAC, the benefit is oftentimes the sellers will remain control. It's an opportunity to raise capital and step into a bigger footprint. You'll have capital to go and deploy. You create a currency for M&A. That means you have a public stock to go ahead and use to make acquisitions. And so for businesses with a robust growth plan looking for capital, this can make a lot of sense. The downside to a SPAC is, as part of structuring the transaction, the financial owners will have a promote structure and a warrant structure such that they get a significant portion of the business. And so there's some dilution to the current owners. If valuation is high enough from the SPAC side, some of that can be offset. But there certainly is a dilutive component to entering a SPAC transaction. And then I don't want to call it a downside. I just want to point it out as a consideration, which is you pop out as a public company, and reporting as a public company is different than as a private company, which we can talk about in detail. So that's going to bring us to the end of this SPAC page. I hope that gives everyone a little bit of flavor for what's something that's very, very active today. I'll do a quick summary on what I hope we covered today, which was, if I was to leave you with 3 points, the first one would be from a valuation perspective. Paul touched on aerospace versus defense, but valuation levels are robust. There's a number of factors for this, but if you look at over time, valuations levels are high. So as a business owner, I think that has implications on both your strategy long term and also your ability to grow, if acquisitions are a component of your growth strategy. Number two, what's driving this? Certainly the availability of capital, but also the expectation for growth and profitability in the industry. We're coming out of a downturn through COVID and some uncertainty, and our view is there are some significant growth drivers in the future. So that would be takeaway number two. And then takeaway number three goes to the prep point. Preparing early and understanding your objectives and really kind of doing some of the blocking and tackling up front to prepare yourself to give you the optionality in the future is something that Paul and I advise all business owners to do. Even a sale or M&A buy side isn't in your future, thinking through the implications of it, we think is time well spent. So maybe with that, I'll wrap Paul and my prepared comments. Would love to leave a little bit of time for Q&A. And I'll leave you, as you guys are thinking about Q&A, I will leave you with one final thought, which is, hopefully you got some value out of this conversation. Paul and I would love to have conversations in a more one-on-one fashion if you find it valuable. This is what we do. We talk about the observations that we're seeing in the industry and really kind of taking to the next step, which would be what are the implications on your specific company or your specific ownership position. So with that, Eric, maybe I'll turn it to you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Scott and Paul. Extremely informative. And it's when you really look back over the last 18 months, we've gone through a paradigm shift with COVID, the economy, the debt, recovery. We really haven't experienced anything like this before. So we do have a couple of questions. So one question that Ivan's put out is when you talk about a growth plan, so shouldn't that five-year growth plan have a starting point at the date of sale? Otherwise, you're selling a blank.
Yeah, I can take a first pass, and maybe, Paul, you can add on. And that's exactly right. If you think about what buyers are looking for, really what they're buying is the future cash flow generation profile of the business. What you've done in the past informs what's happening in the future, but a buyer steps in day one, and they're looking for what does this business do in the future. So, yes, Ivan, you're right. It's really looking forward from the point of sale. So if you're saying, hey, maybe I'll consider something 2 years out, you know, you continue to operate your business, and then you continue to have an eye for the future. One thing worth touching on that I should have mentioned in the prep section, you know, all this prep is something that is very important. The most important part is to continue to operate your business, hit your growth targets, generate the profitability that you're looking to do. Operating your business in a robust manner is clearly the most important step. And by the way, that holds for not only preparing for a sale, but actually executing the sale. Paul, anything you'd like to add on that?
Yeah, maybe just to add a little bit. The you know, it's one thing to make a forecast that's a number on a page as to what you're going to do next year. It's another to make sure that that number is well and truly supported with a plan. The sorts of things that you can do put meat on the bone, if you will, is what contracts can you point to, what purchase orders, industry forecasts, what commentary from customers, et cetera, what trends can you really put to corroborate what you're saying is the likely future of your business. And those are some of the ways that we can, you know, help to add value as you think about how to convince buyers of the believability of your respective forecast.
Okay, thank you. I've been part of five aerospace company sales, and I want to reiterate that you, with your forecast, you have to have support, or your EBITDA or your multiple will get knocked down. They'll use that as, frankly, as leverage, and they should, if you can't validate it. Anything you do to give very firm support on whatever forecast, sales forecast you have, and you have to hit your numbers. So if you pump something up that you can't hit and you start missing numbers, you may lose the potential acquirer. And the other thing is, if you really think about selling your company, is think of who you might sell it to. So you might be positioning your contracts or et cetera. Are you trying to position it to a strategic or a PE firm, or maybe it's back, I guess. But you might want to think about who you're going to sell your company to. So a couple more questions that here. So Paul and Scott, and what I've seen in the industry, we have some suppliers that have excess inventory and some suppliers that got rid of all their inventory. For the major players, do you see that they'll be looking to acquire companies to gain capacity?
Most of what I've seen recently suggests that until there is a firmer path forward on the wide bodies in particular, the existing installed capacity, should be adequate, based on the elevated levels of production in 2018. And even if you go back to 2018, the OEMs were guiding the industry at that point to build capacity to support even higher production levels. So long-winded way of saying, I do believe that the aerospace industry, many of the players in the supply chain have capitalized in terms of facilities and machinery to support production rates that are at or above the levels they were at in 2018. There is certainly a question around how much of that capacity was paired or impaired as a result of decisions that were made to save cash during COVID. I do think that most players were very prudent about retaining, you know, for instance, facilities. Maybe they were shuttered, but they weren't sold. You know, equipment, production equipment, again, shuttered, but not sold. So I do think the industry has a you know, the ability to come back. The human capital is probably the more challenging part of that whole equation, where without a paycheck for 3 months, 6 months, the Paycheck Protection Program certainly helps to help the industry to avoid some of the most potentially difficult decisions. But I think across the industry, most of the players that I've spoken to took staffing levels down that, you know, on the order of 25%. So in some regards, it's not about the facilities or the equipment. It's about, re-recruiting qualified production personnel and restoring the quality to necessary specifications in a timely fashion. So the biggest constraint in re-ramping, I think, is on the people side.
Interesting. Okay. So just maybe this isn't a fair question, but the multiples are so high. Do you see the multiples starting to come back down? I mean, that's, in my opinion, astronomical multiples. 18 is mind-blowing.
Yeah, absolutely. So that 18 number is absolutely driven by the fact that there's such a steep recovery that's forecast in the next, you know, call it 24 months, as, you know, the industry in general terms goes from, you know, 50% run rate levels back to 100% run rate levels. So as we get closer to 100% run rate levels, you know, closer to where we were at in 2018, that 18 will invariably come back down to 12 times, right? So it's kind of, you know, 18 times half of what you used to be making, or 12 times, you know, a full run rate. So the multiple will come down, but the value will stay at, you know, the dollar value, the aggregate dollar value will not necessarily change.
Okay. Along those lines, so Ivan's asked a great question here. How far in advance of a possible exit should you start thinking about the exit? Assuming you've done nothing to date, so how long does it take you to prepare? It probably depends on where you are.
Yeah. I certainly will offer an opinion. Scott's welcome to chime in as well. But my experience is that to do it right, 6 months is not an unreasonable time frame to really consider what your objectives are. Begin the blocking and tackling. For instance, if you don't have audited financials, getting an accountant in to take a look at your existing books and records and provide, you know, fully audited financial trail. You know, those are some things that can take a significant amount of time. So, can it be done faster? Can you possibly do it in 2 months or potentially in a distressed situation faster? Yes, but I think to do it right, 6 months is a more comfortable pace, so that you don't have to, you know, wildly distract yourself from the day-to-day and very important day-to-day of continuing to operate the business. Scott, I don't know if you have any.
Yeah. I'll add one other concept in here, which is, in addition to the audits, we're seeing an analysis run very consistently today called a quality of earnings report. And some of you may have heard that. But so step number one is get your audits done. And then step number two is have a auditing firm, and it can be the same as your auditor, or it can be a different firm. Look at your numbers, and a quality of earnings will add one additional layer of analysis, which is really kind of this run rate concept that Paul is talking about. Audits look at, you know, GAAP accounting, you know, dollars in, dollars out. It's black and white. Quality of earnings, there's a little bit more gray, and you can say, well, you know, we incurred this expense last year to do X, Y, and Z, but that's really not an ongoing expense of the business, so we'll adjust that out. We are highly recommending that business owners consider that path. The reason I bring it up is because, frankly, the audit and the Q of E tend to be the long pole in the tent. That tends to be what takes the most time to prepare. So the question, you know, to directly answer Ivan's question, it really depends on the financial sophistication of the business as it is today. If those are in place and you have the systems and the reporting in place that you can quickly produce an audit. Maybe you're already being audited, or you can quickly produce QV. That's where you get on the tighter end of the time frame. If that needs to be started from you know, ground zero, then it's going to take a little bit longer. Our general view is, and walking through this with everyone today, is we're trying to give you the ammo to best position yourself for a sale. Could you do it more quickly? Probably, but I think Paul and I would say, well, does that best position you to succeed in the marketplace? And that would be the big discussion that we have with you know, the management team and the owners as you're embarking on a sale.
Okay. Well, in order to wrap up here at 9, we're going to cover a little bit more. I want to thank Paul and Scott very much for their insight and sharing your information. It's complex and a bit of a moving target out there, but thank you very much. Really appreciate it. So for all those on board here, thank you for participating. Let me cover some important elements here. So this webinar is recorded. It will be posted on the A&D Forum website under presentations. It's available to all A&D Forum members. All attendees will receive an email when the recording is available, along with the contact information for the attendees that gave permission for the contact information. Upcoming, we have on June 11th, a webinar topic, aviation defense markets within in the aftermath of COVID-19. That's by Richard Abulafia. He's VP of analysis for the Teal Group on June 17th. Let's see, well, July 15th, Future of Widebody, Jens Flatow, Executive Editor of Commercial Aviation Avweek, and that's going to be put on by Santa Cruz Valley and San Fernando Valley, and the prior one by the Ventura Chapter. Next slide, Ivan. Okay, August 26th, Leon Alcalea, co-founder of Varix, founder and CEO of Astrolabs, former JPL Tech Fellow. Ventura County Chapter, and on September 23, Business Health Assessment, Whether Exiting or Not. This is much along the lines of what we're just talking about. Larry O'Toole, founder of Yosemite Associates, LA Chapter. Larry's done this multiple times, so that's going to be very important if you're thinking about what's going on with your business. Let's see, Ivan, do we have another slide here? Yes. So there's over 250 recordings of chapter and webinar presentations. They're available for download by A&D Forum members. An individual membership is $350 a year, in addition to free attendance to all A&D Forum meetings and webinars. Membership is free for those not located near one of the 9 operating chapters. You can join the mailing list of any chapters for free, which will provide you the monthly A&D Forum newsletter. An opportunity to sponsor chapters and to sponsor webinars are available, and we encourage that. For more info, go to aerospacedefenseforum.org. All right, my next last slide here. Again, thank you very much for all the participants, and Scott and Paul for your preparation and presentation, and we look forward to seeing you at the next chapter forum meeting. Take care.